Okay, we're in Free Church Report number 34, and I notice I don't have any questions on the right-hand side of the panel, so I'm going to leave it to all of you guys to come up with good questions that will help other people who hear this recording at a later time. We'll get right into it. This should be a pretty simple chapter, but and for a lot of you it probably is. We've gone over several chapters before this, and this is kind of the culmination of that topic. Which has to do with unique separateness of the church, what incorporation does when you incorporate a church, but how do you actually define a church? Where should you be getting its doctrines from? Should men be privately interpreting the Bible and coming up with new doctrines based on bits and pieces of the gospel, or were Christ's doctrines enough? So in this recording number 34, we're looking at the church is defined by Christ. Christ has designated the rules of our charter by which we must be governed. And it's amazing, you know, I went to the seminary and I listened to priests and I was in Baptist churches and Methodist churches and Assembly of Gods. And almost none of these ministers mentioned the very specific direct statements of Christ as to what his disciples should do, should not do, what he commanded the disciples to do, what he was condemning the Pharisees for not doing and doing. And today the modern church has more in common with the Pharisees in essential practices and behavior than they have in common with the early church. And that's just something that we can historically examine. But today we're going to examine at least this definition of the church that we find in Black's Law Dictionary, which you would think would not be a good definition, but actually it really is a remarkable definition, and we should look at it because there is no other legal definition of the church that is given to us by governments. Not that they have a right to define the church, but it's interesting that in Black's Law Dictionary, for Black's 3, Black's 4, Black's 5, Black's 6, Black's 7, Black's 8, 9th edition, now they're getting into editions that are starting to add more and more stuff, like a church can be a building. But the definition that was pretty consistent most of this time, there was, at one time, they did not capitalize the pronoun his, but then they started capitalizing it. But in this Black's Third Dictionary definition, we see in its most general sense, as the church is defined as the religious society founded and established by Jesus Christ to receive, preserve, propagate his doctrines and ordinances. Now, you can go look at the doctrines of all these churches that I mentioned, and their doctrines, even their creeds, are not, very seldom are quoting the actual directives of Jesus Christ. I find that astounding. But they just kind of, you know, because of the fact that people don't want to admit that they might be doing something wrong, they don't even want to look at it. They're not even interested in it. But it has to be founded and established by Jesus Christ. If you incorporate, which we're going to go over here in a minute, it nullifies any previous incorporation or founding or establishing by Jesus Christ. It absolutely does that. It states it does that in the law. The second part of the definition is it's a body or community. So in the first part, it was a religious society, and a body and a community in the second paragraph of Christians, assuming that Christians are those who follow Christ, not those who just think they follow Christ, not those who say they follow Christ, but actually are following the directives of Christ, united under one form of government by the profession of one faith. Now, you can profess your faith in a lot of different ways, but you can't just say. You have to profess your faith in doing. You can't just say you love Jesus. You actually have to, if you love him, you will keep his commandments. So if you're not keeping his commandments, then you don't really love him no matter what you say. So, because your profession really needs to be in word and deed. Goes on to say, and the observance of the same rituals and ceremonies. Now, we'll probably talk about those rituals and ceremonies in other places. When you say words like rituals and ceremonies, people begin to think of how you practice your religion. You know, do you have vestments, incense? Do you sing a lot? These are your rituals and your holy matrimony, your matrimony. Most churches today, not only are they incorporated, they only marry people by the authority vested in them by the state of XXX. So their rituals and ceremonies are really the rituals and ceremonies of the state. Their covetous practices, because they don't take care of the widows and orphans and needy of society anymore, most of that is done by the state that they're incorporated to. The doctrines of Christ include all kinds of things, like the ministers were to sell all they have, give to the poor, and hold all things in common, and have a daily administration, you know, a daily bread, providing, you know, feed my sheep. And that's what we see the first century church doing, but the modern church doesn't do that. Modern church has the state do that, or the society in which they have incorporated the church. So really, there's almost no churches left that are founded and established by Jesus Christ. There's a few that claim that, but then we have to ask, are they receiving, preserving, and propagating his doctrines and ordinances, or have they decided to do something else? And so those are questions you should keep in mind as we continue through the book and through this chapter. What is the church? You need to find it defined in your own minds so that you're not just studying, that you're going to actually start implementing things in your life. So it goes on to describe what I just talked about, a religious society founded and established by Jesus Christ, who is its pre-existing authority. Remember, a corporation is that two or more people gather together for a particular purpose under a pre-existing authority. So they depart from that pre-existing authority of its creator upon an incorporation to the state. Now the state has refounded it, and in the chapter just before, we saw that the state actually says that if you incorporate under the authority of the state, all other previous incorporation is null and void as if it never took place. So incorporation by Jesus Christ never existed, and the church is now whole, is now established by the state, and is a part of the body of the whole state, and merged with its domain. Its powers are limited, authorized, preserved by the state. Such actions of the church is adultery with the state, and is what you would call sacrilege. Remember, to sanctify something, to make something sacred, is to make it separate. Incorporate is a sacrilege. It's going back the other way. If the church was a body or community of Christians, because that there's a more general definition where it's the whole community. See, from one point of view, the ecclesia, the called out church, is those ministers he called out. The congregation was not actually a part of that called out. That's the body that called out are supposed to serve. And they're not a corporate body, but they are a collection of individuals, not a common purse, not, you know, a collective corporate body. They are free souls under God. But the church belongs to God, like the Levites before them. They actually belong to God. They have no estate in the land. What they own in common. And they really don't own it. Christ owns it because they themselves belong to God. That's absolutely essential. The church as individuals cannot own land. Therefore, they cannot sign that land away. They can't lose it. It has to be stolen, or they have to all die, or they have to disappear off the face of the earth. So if the church was a body or community of Christians, using that term in the most general sense, united under that one form of government, which is operating according to the perfect law of liberty, and it becomes a corpus or body united under the state and its form of government, then the church no longer meets the definition of a church by Black's Law Dictionary, because it's not established by the state anymore. So they call it a religious organization, or they call it a lot of other things, but it really, and then of course they, when they're not speaking technically, they may call it a church. But the church has been unchurching itself on a regular basis with a lack of knowledge. They just don't get it. They just don't understand. And we're seeing that about a lot of things in the news, and we'll be talking about that on the programs on the weekend, which are, I try to incorporate some of the topics on the weekend with these studies. So anyway, that form which the modern state complies with is one of an exercising authority, like the rulers of the Gentiles. And the state has been warned us that applying to or going under the state will bring the disadvantages which stem from the strict operational restrictions by the state or by the agencies of the state, which if you go down to footnote 218, it says the disadvantages of exemption under 501c3, which isn't necessarily incorporation, it's just applying, filing a 1023 with the IRS, stems from the strict operational restrictions. And that quote is from the detailed analysis of Tax Management Incorporated, a subsidiary of the Bureau of National Affairs Incorporated. And it gives you the references there so that you can see that they tell you that if you file these documents and become incorporated, you cease becoming a church under Christ, and now you become some sort of religious institution under the state or under the authority of agencies of the state, and you will become strictly regulated. Everybody was so excited that Trump was going to lift some of the restrictions that came with 501c3, the next president can put them right back again. The problem is the church should have never looked to be established by either the IRS or the Commerce Department or any kind of state incorporation agency. It should have already been the church established by Christ. It existed long before the United States ever came into existence. It does not need to reestablish itself in the state. But in order to do that, you have to have ministers that are actually called out and are separate. And those ministers are also separate from the congregations. And the congregations are separate from those ministers, because the status of the church cannot be dependent upon the status of the congregation, because that's a huge, there's a great variety of statuses amongst the congregation. But we can still serve them in faith, hope, and charity, but we can't have them exercising control over the ministers. They exercise control over their contributions, but not to the over the ministers themselves, and their contributions are only contributions when they relinquish their control. So this way, the people keep their purse in their pocket and the power in their own pocket, and so they will have an effect on the church by that, but they don't have an authority over the church, because if they do, you again compromise the separate nature of the church, and you commit sacrilege, because you are affecting the sanctity of the church, the separateness of the church. So we see it is important to understand that to be considered exempt is not the same as being exempted by the grace of the state or by the grace of Christ for that fact. They may be considered exempt by the grace of Jesus Christ, the King of the citizens of Judea, and therefore of the kingdom of God, which, because Judea was the remnant of Israel. And in the United States, though, neither the Internal Revenue Department nor the Department of Treasury need grant the church an exemption. I'll give you another quote. Some organizations are not required to file a 1023. These include churches, interchurches, organizations of local units of churches, conventions or associations of a church, such as men's or women's organizations, religious schools, missions, societies, and youth groups. Now, most schools need to file these papers. You know, most private schools and most private religious schools do, because the churches that are operating those religious schools do not really qualify as the church. It is very important that any organization that is created and controlled by the church remain entirely controlled by those separate ministers. They can be funded by the people, but they do it by giving to the church and the church funding those other institutions, whether mission societies or women's organizations. Now, if a women's organization wants to exist and take care of its own funding, then it may have to file a 1023. But if it's really staying under the coverture of that separate church, it would already automatically be considered exempt. So anyway, this is not any particularly favoritism on the part of the state, but the result of a lack of jurisdiction of the state in matters concerning the free church. But it has to be really that free church. You have to have those factors that Christ stipulated for the church. And there's a reason for that, even in natural law and most laws in most countries today. The church was established by another pre-existing authority, Yeshua, the Messiah, Jesus, the Christ. Christ simply is the anointed. It means Messiah, so it's kind of redundant there. The free church may be in a state, but they are simply not a part of that state or the world, as we see the word in meaning cosmos, that jurisdictional state. They are already established under the perfect law of liberty by another authority. In 1994, the IRS publication 557 stated, "These organizations are exempt automatically if they meet the requirements of Section 501c3, except for the fact that there are no requirements for a church. There's requirements for charitable organizations and institutions, but they're exempt automatically." Goes on to say, however, if the organization wants to establish its exemption with the Internal Revenue Service and receive a ruling or determination letter recognizing its exempt status, it should file Form 1023 with the key district director. In 2005, bureaucrats had slightly changed the wording to read, "These organizations are exempt automatically if they meet the requirements of Section 501c3, but in both cases, the words exempt automatically applies because of the status of a true church. It goes on to quote, "Filing Form 1023 to establish exemption." And this is actually what it says right there. If the organization wants to establish its exemption with the IRS and receive ruling or determination letter recognizing its exempt status, it should file Form 1023. And there's references there on the pages to where I'm getting these quotes. The free church has established its exemption through the Christ, the King, the Messiah. To establish its exemption with the Internal Revenue Service is to reject Christ and make the IRS its overseer and protector. Are there any requirements that a free church must meet which can be imposed upon it by the state. In the same publication, we see phrases like, if you are organized to operate a home for an agent or following information must be submitted, or if you are a scientific organization, you must show, etc. But for religious organizations, there are only two basic guidelines, which are merely maintained by the Internal Revenue Service. These mere guidelines are to determine whether recognition of exemption should appropriately be extended to an organization seeking to meet the religious purpose test of Section 501c3. I'm just going to read right through this and then we'll come back to explain it a little bit more. In order to determine whether the recognition of exemption should be appropriately be extended to an organization seeking to meet the religious purpose test of Section 501c3, the Internal Revenue Service maintains two basic guidelines. Now, this is in another quote. That the particular religious beliefs of the organization are truly and sincerely held, and that the practices and rituals associated with those organizations' religious beliefs or creed are not illegal or contrary to clearly defined public policy. Well, they have actually allowed some churches with very peculiar or church type organizations. They're not real churches based on that original legal definition because they weren't established by Christ. But, like peyote, they want to consume peyote, which would be considered illegal, but they let them do it because it's a part of a religious institution. They fight this in the court and all that stuff. Those aren't things that we're seeking. What we want to do is do what Christ said to do, because we have to follow, as the definition says, his doctrines and ordinances. So we'll go through this final thing here. It says it should be noted that a church, its integrated auxiliaries, or a convention or association of churches is not required to file 1023 to be exempt from federal income tax or to receive a tax deductible contribution. And again, I have footnotes there as to where I'm getting that. The Department of Treasury IRS Publication 557, tax exempt status of your organization. Now, those are the things that they actually state, that the funds that you give to a church are already tax exempt. The deductions are, you can make those deductions. And yet I see people all the time going and, in churches, can't believe that the church is separate. But now from our point of view, the only one who can really define the church is Yeshua, Jesus, the Messiah, the Christ. And so he said we had to do certain things. And we'll be getting to a lot of those things in the subsequent chapters. But I came across a story just today. I was talking to a guy who has I'll call it a resource lot. Some people call it a junkyard, but I like to call it a resource lot. But he was approached by the state of Oregon years and years and years ago. I mean, it must be 20 some years ago now, maybe more. And because I remember when they approached him. And there have been a few other guys who have come by since. And they said that he had to have his junkyard licensed. And he needed to get his licensing up to date. Well, he never had a license. This had been accumulated since his mother and his dad were there. And it's been there all this time. And it's run rather efficiently. And he said, well, okay, I'll look over the paperwork, leave it all here, and I will... I'll read it over and fill it out according to what I think is right. And so anyway, he was reading it over and he said that he found a little spot down there. It was about the size of a little business card and had really tiny, tiny little print on it. And he read that and he can still quote it pretty good. I'll try to quote it from what he told me today and from what I could imagine it was said there, that what they say, that if once you sign this, you're agreeing that if the state decides there shouldn't be a junkyard there, you have 90 days to get everything removed. You have to remove it at your own expense somewhere else. If they decide somewhere down the road that you should not have a junkyard there, you have 90 days to remove it. And you're agreeing to that if you sign those papers. And there were a couple other things that you were also agreeing to, but he wasn't going to sign those. And he told them that. And the next time he told them in no uncertain terms he wasn't going to sign. And it's like 20 years now. He has no contract with them. And they leave him alone. And it's a big junkyard lined up with cars and trucks and combines and everything there. But he didn't sign the contract. So they, now if he had signed that contract, they could do all kinds of, they'd just go down with that contract and show the court that we've decided shouldn't be a junkyard there and he hasn't removed the stuff. His 90 days are up, so they can actually come in there and they can move all the stuff and bill him for it and put a lien on his property for it. And then they can come in and detect whether or not he's got oil leaks or what have you. And, I mean, it could just be a total nightmare and devastate him financially. But he never signed the contract. Now that's, he just did it because he decided he wasn't going to do it. But in the Ten Commandments, it says you're not to make covenants with these people. But that is exactly what that application would be. So we see this same thing that we're seeing here for the church. In all aspects of life in governments, even the one-child contract in China. Now, that's a totalitarian dictatorship, but they want you to sign a one-child contract. And then you have that one child, and they give you benefits. All kinds of benefits, extra pay, you get free shoes, allotments, and free education. Everything is free for that one child. Your wife gets pregnant again, she has to have an abortion. They will take her in and force her to have an abortion, but you can actually get out of it, the abortion, if you pay back all the benefits you've received for the first child. I know people in China who have a dozen kids. Well, maybe not a dozen. It seems like a dozen. There's at least eight kids in the household. And they never signed the one-child contract. They took care of their kids themselves. And now, of course, we're finding that there's a lot more women children in China than people have counted because they've kept them secret because of the one-child contracts and because of, you know, they wanted to have another child, so they didn't tell anybody about the first child. So there are possibly millions of unregistered female children in China because the registering, which is what you do in order to obtain benefits, that's a contract. And there are restrictions. You want to know what the restrictions are? You got to go look in the statutes and read the statutes. I couldn't tell you how many ministers were absolutely shocked when they found out that, you know, even when they bring the form in, we had an incident where a pastor brought the form in and said he wanted the parishioners to fill out the 1023. And he did it when I wasn't there in that church. It was the only community church, and he was an invited minister that they let come in to talk, and the people wanted him. It was fine. I wasn't too pleased with him, but it's a community church, non-denominational community, unincorporated community church. But he wanted him to fill out this 1023, and he brought it in when I was gone on a trip back east for other church matters. Well, my 14-year-old daughter looked at the form, flipped it over, read the instructions on the back, and she held it up and she says, "Churches don't have to fill out this form. It says it right here in the instructions." And then all heck broke loose. But she wasn't being facetious. She just said, "Well, it says here on the back, churches are not required to fill out this form. We're a church. That form is for schools and charitable organizations and scientific organizations and that are nonprofit, but it's not for churches. It said it right on the form." But how many churches? You can't, if you went down the street, wherever you live, and you asked them, did they file a 1023? They did. And they did. And they did. And they did. And that's why they're strictly regulated. But what we should be mostly concerned with is the fact that the churches are not doing what Christ said they should do. Obviously, we shouldn't be signing contracts. We don't have a right to sign contracts on behalf of Christ. We should be providing the services that Christ said to provide and doing it through faith, hope, and charity. And the congregation should be gathering together for that purpose. So anyway, on the right-hand side, I talk about the church legally defined. I have a link to a whole article on the church legally defined. The legal ramifications of the church incorporated. You can go back to the previous chapters we just did. I also have a link to the body of Christ versus the body of the state, which was the first pamphlet and a part of the book, The Covenants of the Gods. So anyway, basically, we're going to have to start looking at what the church, the role of the church, the called out ministers is, how do they fulfill the commands of Christ? And we're also going to have to look at the roles of the congregation of the people that those ministers are supposed to be serving and how they do that. You can ask questions you may even know the answer to that you may think help clear something up for somebody else. But we see here in this chapter, and there's lots of footnotes down there. I didn't read all the footnotes, but there's lots of footnotes down there that churches are not only already exempt and automatically exempt, but they also have an automatic deduction for the contributions to a church. And they had those two basic criteria. There's actually 14 criteria that they have written up, not for churches, but for bureaucrats, you know, like IRS agents or revenue agents of some sort, to look at to help them determine if they're even looking at a church. But that isn't, we're not required to keep all 14 of those. We have letters that say that we are, and we actually are. I think we could do a lot better job if the people would gather together as Christ commanded. But we had to have this chapter in there. And now, of course, this doesn't all apply to places like Australia or Sweden. But actually, my experience with some looking at Canada, looking at Australia, and looking at some other countries in Europe, that they have very similar laws in their country as well, because and they're there because of a particular very powerful organization that is calling itself the church has made sure that those provisions are in statutes all over the world, which is partly why I believe that you see the Black's Law Dictionary going and suddenly deciding to capitalize the word his, because that's a custom of that other church. Wherever you see a pronoun in relationship to Christ, they capitalize it. And so somebody somewhere along the line just decided in Black's Law Dictionary that that pronoun should be capitalized when referencing Christ. So anyway, we have other quotes in. We have a question. Great.
Hi, Brother Gregory.
Yes.
Yeah, it's Isabel in New York. I just want to make sure I have this understood correctly, that the IRS had the church defined correctly when they offered an exemption without needing the church to file a 1023?
A church is automatically considered exempt even if it does not file a 1023. Now, one of the things when you'll see a word that pops around there is that if you file a 1023, what you're doing is requesting that you are established as a church by the determination letter of the IRS. Now, what that does is now the IRS, because you thought you needed them to determine that you're a church, they have the right to withdraw that determination. That's why it is important that in the document right there on the 1023, it says churches don't have to file this. So what you're really doing when you file that is you're saying you're not a church and that you want to go under the authority of the IRS. You're wanting to say that you want your exemption by permission and by determination of the IRS, not by the determination of Christ. Now you go under all kinds of rules, and they state that. They say you become, when they have a list of the advantages and disadvantages of filing a 1023. You know, I didn't put the whole document down, but if you file a 1023, the disadvantages, you become strictly regulated. If you don't file that, you're not strictly regulated. So now they can say, well, you're a political action committee. You're not a church. Because they can impose all kinds of rules on you once you fill that out. If you don't fill that out, all they can do is say, are your beliefs sincerely held? And I can't remember what was the other one they said. And that the practices and rituals associated with the organization, religious beliefs or creeds are not illegal or contrary to clearly defined public policy. Well, that means, you know, you can't be beating people. You can't be killing people. You can't be raping people, which, you know, in the Church of Satan, they do that. Other than that, they don't have a right to touch you. And I can give you a go down and show lots of examples of churches that understand this. Of course, the Catholic Church is very clear on this. I'll give you an example. The Catholic Church in Connecticut suddenly saw the Connecticut Congress trying to pass a law that churches needed to have a civilian review board of the funds that they spend, and to make sure that the funds were not being misused. So, I mean, in the Catholic Church, you know, the priests and the bishops decide all this. Mostly the bishops decide how the funds are being spent. And but they're a top-down church. The bishop is giving directives to the local priests all the time. They have to do this, they have to do that. That's not the way Christ Church works. But the Catholic Church does know that the congregation cannot dictate how money is spent after the money has been given, because then the church is not autonomous. Now, so immediately they just, the Knights of Columbus and everybody was up in arms and was getting every Catholic in Connecticut to write the legislature and stop this bill, because they were not going to let that bill go into place. There was not going to be a civilian review board of how the Catholic Church spent its money, because it knew the sovereignty of the bishopric. I mean, the local churches are already compromised, but the bishopric is not. And the Catholic Church actually was one of the ones who brought in this whole 501c3 thing. But they knew that the bishops had to stay clear of that. And what they did was they brought all the Baptist churches, the Methodist churches, the Assembly of God's under the power of the state, because those churches don't have this hierarchy that is separate. From our point of view, we want all of our ordained ministers to be separate, and our bishops do not dictate the money spent or given and received in the local congregations, because we operate under the perfect law of liberty. The Catholic Church does not operate under the perfect law of liberty. Their authority goes all the way to the top. Our authority goes to Christ, and Christ speaks to every minister in his heart and in his mind. So that's distinctively different. You got another question? Let's go to the other question. Maybe we'll get it all covered, and we'll come back to that.
Yeah, Gregory Michael Smith, I am just astounded at the stuff that you're teaching, because I've never heard anybody tell me this stuff. Never heard it in any churches. Now, I'm just loving every minute of it and wishing I could just impute this into the minds of everybody. I can't stand civil government. I can't stand having lawyers and civil courts and licenses and city halls. And I just wish it would all go away and we could be free.
Well, it will all go away, but the important thing is that, and this is what we're going to be getting into more and more in the book, is that and we've touched on it here in that original definition, that the church is one form of government. This is the word government, because of all those things you were just listing off there, the word government today, if anybody says government, you think somebody who's running your life, somebody who's exercising authority, somebody who's controlling your choices and decisions. And they say that's government. But no, there's actually a government that operates according to the it's a government, but it's not like those governments, you know, like those governments of the Gentiles. And we have that quote in this on this page, and it's down in the footnotes. And, you know, it's in at least very clearly in three of the Gospels, Matthew 20:25, Mark 10:42, Luke 22:25. They are telling you that we are a government. He's appointing a kingdom, a government, a basileia in the Greek, to these men he's called out to be separate, but they're not to exercise authority. They're not to tax the people. They're not to rule over the people. They're not to control the people, but they are to serve the people. Now, clearly, Paul goes on and says, well, if somebody is a backbiter and a gossiper and a divider of the people and perverting the natural use and all these things, we're not to be feeding them. We're not to be helping them. We're not to be encouraging their immorality. Today, in the society created by the state, they feed the cancer. They poison the people. So, but you're absolutely right. You won't hear this in most of the churches. And when I say most, I mean like 99% of the churches, you won't hear this. I didn't hear it in the churches. But really what, and I talked about the ministers about this, that we need to be able to hear the truth about everything, not just about what we don't like, but also about the things in our own heart and our own mind. And we become that government. Yes, go ahead.
All right, so in my studies and something urging me to know the truth about everything, and that's why I'm so attracted to what you're writing and other people, I read things like the Body of Liberties, which was what, in the 1600s, where they wouldn't have attorneys in the courts, and then the original 13th Amendment. So were these things motivated by people who were following Christ? I mean, apparently there were times when people tried not to have civil government, or at least some of the things that we think they tried to do.
Well, now, this is also going to be a topic that I'm going to cover in the radio programs on the weekend, because I've come across this. There's literally, you know, I've talked about it, the collective unconsciousness and the collective consciousness. People who think they know already, people who are full of vanity and anger and resentment, they're not going to be able to see things clearly. They're going to make bad choices. This is why, in order to, you know, I'm showing people that they miss some very basic information that's right there in the Gospels. They were blind and did not see things that the state told them. If you file this, you become strictly regulated. And they did it anyway. They said right in the form, you don't have to file this. And yet they still go do it. What is driving them to do this? They're telling you not to do it. They're telling you you don't have to do it. They're telling that you will become controlled. And yet they come in saying you have. And it's very interesting when my 14-year-old daughter pointed this out to the minister that, wait a minute, it says churches don't have to file this. And I said, all heck broke loose. Why was he getting so angry? All she did was read the instructions. She just read what it says right there on the form. Because there's a spirit in him that wants you to become subject, wants you to become stupid, wants your children dumbed down, wants your children to become easily controlled, manipulated, and enslaved. And that spirit is working in these people. The people that are destroying the world today don't know what they're doing. They're blindly following a spirit that is dwelling in them. When Christ was casting out demons, this is what's actually what we're facing. That you go talk to some of the liberals and millennialists, I hate to give this as an example, but this keeps coming to the top of my mind. I just shared it on Facebook where some doctors did some studies and they're saying that we should not be telling new mothers that breastfeeding is natural. They don't want them using the word natural to describe breastfeeding anymore, because it's leading. Their study shows that women who breastfeed are becoming the anti-vaxxers who don't want to get vaccines for their children. They're also starting to become homeschoolers. And they're saying that it's leading to these, what they consider to be subversive behaviors, homeschooling, not taking vaccinations. They consider that subversive. And they see the cause is that the mothers are nursing their children. And they're nursing their children because you said it was natural to do that. Well, of course, it is natural. What does Paul say in Romans about perverting the natural use of things? I mean, isn't that what we see going on? The rise of homosexuality, the rise of perversions, even not homosexuality, just... the natural use, the woman is no longer, the purpose of the woman is not to have children. But, the people don't pick a wife because she's going to be a good mother. They pick her because she's a good date or whatever. I don't want to get crude in it, but what's driving people? It's the spirit of selfishness. It's a spirit of judgment. It's a spirit of anger. It's a spirit of resentment. If we want, we're beginning to wake up and we see, if we want to see more, we have to immerse ourselves in forgiveness and leave judgment to God. We have to start giving, sacrificing ourselves for others. What brought the whole world into bondage? Selfishness. Covetous practices. Sloth, self-indulgence, judgment, biting one another has caused us to become devoured. Covetous practices have made us merchandise, cursed our children. I just heard a man today asking a senator in Oregon, and it's kind of bizarre that I actually overheard this, but that's another story. But his name was Jeff, and he was asking Walden, I guess is the name of the... I think he's a senator. Maybe he's the congressman. But anyway, maybe he is a congressman from Oregon to the United States government. But he's asking him, he says, we have to do something about this deficit budget because we're passing this on to our children. That's taxation without representation because they're going to be taxed and they didn't have any say-so in this because this is what we're passing on. We have to reduce the budgets. Well, I could have interjected, but the guy was getting it anyway. He was waking up to the fact that we're cursing the next generation, which is what Peter told us that we would do 2,000 years ago. And I'll bet you don't hear that in churches either. We're cursing the next generation because we think we solved the government shutdown because they raised the debt ceiling. They can't see what they're doing. They're destroying their children. They're destroying their nation. They're destroying their lives. And the reason why is they're following a spirit that is literally possessing their mind and writing upon their hearts and their minds. You want God to write upon your heart and your mind. So you have to let God be God. You can't judge them for all the wrongs they do. See it, but don't judge them. I told the ministers, I'm happier now more and more because I'm leaving more and more judgment behind. I can talk about these things and I'm not getting as upset as I used to because I know there's a God. I see him working. And I know that this salvation comes when we stop playing God and playing church and start being the children of God and start doing and leaving judgment to him, start taking care of one another, start doing what Christ actually said. And so, yeah, I'm going to try to put all this down in these recordings so that other churches can see this. And we already have, you know, I have recordings with the, if you go to the link that talks about the body of Christ and the body of the state versus the body of the state, there's at least an hour, maybe 2 hours of recordings going through that. And so that's there, but why can't they hear it? You know, I talk to ministers and I show them this and they're astounded. And that sometimes they start whispering because the spirit in them won't let them speak up because the spirit that is in them is not the spirit of Christ. When the spirit of Christ is in you, they can't shut you up. If Christ wants you to speak, you will speak and you will speak the right thing. But the spirit of Christ is not the spirit of anger. Yeah, I understand all those things are bad. I understand that they have deceived the whole world. But the whole world has kind of wanted to be deceived because they didn't want to see the truth. You want to become the light, not the blowtorch. You want to become, you know, that still small voice for other people. I tell you that the more we listen to that still small voice, the more we become at peace knowing that God can straighten this out and make things right, the more we can bring his blessings to other people. So anyway, is there another question somewhere?
No, the board's clear.
Okay, because we've got to the end of our hour. But everybody should be in a congregation and make sure that their ministers show up for the minister's calls because we're going to start going to another level of understanding here. And this particular chapter, I think, is kind of a pivotal point to that. But anyway, I thank you all for coming, and peace on your house, and may God be with you.